Blog Talk Radio.
Hey, Blog Talk Radio. It's Rebooting the News on another Monday morning here, and with me and Jay Rosen. Jay?
Hi, Dave.
I
heard you're coming east.
I am. It's true. You heard that? Where'd you hear that?
It's all around the place, and guess what?
What?
I'm coming west.
You're kidding. When are you coming west?
I'm going to San Francisco on October 1st to attend the Online News Association convention.
Huh. And really?
Yes, which will be more than 1,000 people interested in online journalism at the San Francisco Hilton, and I'll be there from Thursday to Sunday.
Thursday to Sunday. Well, we should definitely try to get. That's really funny because, like, I'm flying back to California on Wednesday night, which is the 30th, one day before
mm-hmm.
you come out here.
And I'm coming your way on Thursday. We should consider doing a live Rebooting the News.
I really want to. You know, I mean, I proposed doing that at Online News Association, and they didn't pick it up.
We can do it with ourselves.
Yeah, we'll find a place to do it. We will. I mean, it would be kind of interesting to do one with an audience, don't you think? Like with a live audience sitting right there in the room.
We could find to probably get some fans of the podcast together in a tweet-up way on Monday night or something.
Oh, yeah. No. It would definitely be fun. Okay, we should move on, but let's put that on the list of things to do.
You know? Right. So you have a little announcement from the Dave Weiner Software Shop, don't you?
Yeah, with great trepidation because, Top Twits is the name of the product, and it's the open source release of the application that you and I and Kevin Toffel and Zach Seward and a few other people use to track our links that we flow through Twitter. And they've been much in demand. Every time people see it, they go, somebody says, oh, can I have that? And I don't, you know, it's like, it's work I didn't want to take on, you know. It's support, right? I mean, as you know, when things do go wrong in these systems, and, you know, when something goes wrong, you'll get an email from, you know, very nice people, but they want to know when their service is going to be back. And,
right.
You know, and you start adding that up, and it starts really, really, I mean, right now it's very manageable, but if I were to add 20 or 30 people, that would become a full-time job with absolutely no hope of ever getting paid for it, and I've been there and done it, and I don't like it. It's not fun for me. So I sort of cut it off, and then when they announced that Trim was going open source, I said, here's my opportunity to sort of get into the spirit of this, and I'll just announce that I'm going to open source this. So last week you asked me about this. I don't know if it was off air or on air or whatever, but that got me off my butt, and I put it on my to-do list for this week amongst quite a few other things and got it out. Now the question is, will anybody actually use it? And I have my doubts that anybody will, but we'll see what happens.
So if I'm a user and I want to have a 40Twits site for myself to track my top links
mm-hmm.
sent out through Twitter and how many people clicked on them over the last few weeks, how would I use this release to gain a 40Twits page for myself?
Well, you go to docs.40twits.com and you start reading. And there's it's a how-to there. It's like any, you know, piece of software, you know. Well, it's not. It's a sort of half end user, half, you know, sysadmin type thing.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to read it. You might have to read the docs two or three times and try it. And, you know, it'll be, you know, there's a lot of configuration to do. You have to set up an account with, you have to choose between Adjix and Trim. That's one of your choices. So Adjix is nice. I recommend Adjix. Because it does everything that Trim does, but it also allows you to do two things. One is you can have your own custom domain, which is how, you know, you do jr.ly, which you like so much and everybody else likes a lot too. And so you could do that, and you can also have a backup of all of the URLs that you shortened go to Amazon S3 bucket. And that way, if Adjix ever goes down or disappears or fails, you know, I say if, but I really should say when. It's, you know, these things will not ever be around forever, you know, and so you really should be planning for that. And so that approach does do that, and Trim right now does not offer those features. However, if you would like to use Trim, you can do that too, and it's a matter of just configuring it instead of to go that way. So, you know, it can be done. I did it, you know, many times in testing this. I worked on making it easy. I believe it is easy, or as easy as it can possibly be.
Excellent.
I'm putting a lot of disclaimers out there. I hope you get that.
Yeah.
Because I don't want people to say, oh, but you said it was easy, and it turns out I have to actually do some work. Well, you do have to do some work. The other thing is that I want to mention is that you can, if you're willing to dig, roll up your sleeves a little bit and dig a little bit deeper, you can set up one of these systems for a community of people if you want to. It's the exact same software that I'm using. So, you know, and I have some clues in there on how to do that. And if you, you know, make a good effort at doing it and you hit some, you have some problems or whatever, you can post a questionnaire and I'll try to help. But no sort of like blank stares or will you do it for me or whatever, because no, I won't do it for you. This is an open source release. It also means, by the way, that people can adopt the project and take it and fork it and do whatever they want with it. You know, you can take this code and make it whatever you'd like it to be, you know.
Oh, I think people will do something with it. There are so many people have expressed an interest in it. That I
really
think,
wonder about that. I really
I think
do.
They will.
Because when they look at it, Jay, I think this is what they're going to see. There isn't a whole lot there. I mean, you know, it's sure there's some nice sort of how-to stuff in there. It sort of documents how something like this would work. But once you figure that out, if you're at all technical, it's not that hard to set one of these things up.
Huh, well,
so,
true.
Yeah.
I
don't know how it'll be used, I think, is what I'm trying to say. And I'm keeping an open mind for that.
I just think people want a page like you and I have. That's all.
Yeah, I don't doubt that.
That's what I mean.
Yeah, yeah.
So with this little product, the art of curation, which we both agree is key to the rebooted system of news, takes another step forward.
Yeah. Well, it's a tool for that. Absolutely. Yes.
It's a tool for that because you can see how successful you are at distributing links.
Mm-hmm.
Your users can talk to you, and you can learn how to both listen to that and not pay too much attention to it, which I think is an important editorial art. You know, a lot of traditional news people have always been freaked out by the idea of getting numbers on users' behavior, whether it's ratings in television or clicks on the internet. There's always been this idea that if you know too much, you'll become slavishly devoted to what the users want. And I really think this is kind of an immature attitude. Is we have to learn how to work with metadata without becoming enslaved to it. And I think a lot of people understand that, but there's still kind of a hangover from an earlier era where it was possible to work without this. I think today it's absolutely necessary to know what is working.
Right. Oh, I totally agree. I can't imagine doing it any other way. I mean, I never got that religion at all. I mean, you go back to like when I was ran a software publishing company. We used to, you know, put registration cards in the back of the manuals, and, you know, really tried to like incentivize people to fill them out and let us know what they thought of the product. And when those would come back, sometimes in stacks, I would stop everything and just sit down and read them, you know? I mean, I especially like when they wrote back and said, you know, even if they didn't like the product, that they took the time to actually tell me what they felt, how they felt about it. That was all very valuable data and very influential, too. I mean, these thoughts would stay with me, you know, when I had to make decisions about it. So I really think it's important. And I don't understand the mindset where you don't want to hear from people. I just don't get it.
Well, it's one of the strange things that developed during the era of monopoly news provision and easy money and a stable economy in news organizations, you had these separations grow up between editorial and business, between, you know, doing journalism and selling ads. And unfortunately, the people on the editorial side began to invest these separations with kind of magic significance. One of the consequences of that is that people producing the news, working on the editorial end of the operation, often didn't have any data at all about the people that they were doing journalism for. And they lost control, in fact, of the data within the organizations. They weren't the keepers of it. They weren't able to ask for it in better form. Others would interpret it for them, and they would be kind of clients for those interpretations. And all of that was actually very damaging to their cause, because if you don't own the numbers, you don't know them, and you can't interpret them, you can't argue
damaging
for your
to
case.
Whose cause? You say damaging to their. Who's that? Who's
well, that? Their ability to...
Who's they?
To the people working in the newsroom, the
okay,
journalists,
the
editors and reporters.
Okay,
yeah.
The reporters, okay.
Yeah.
I wasn't sure on that, yeah.
And the editors and the people making journalism as opposed to the MBAs and business people, run, you know, supposedly running the business. So they lost control of their data. They didn't know that much about it. They would be sometimes forced to read statistics on users and readers and declines and stuff, but they didn't necessarily ask for good data, ask for good feedback, because they saw that as kind of subtly or sometimes blatantly corrupting.
Well,
and I understand the mentality. I mean, there is such a thing as ratings-driven news, right? There is
a
formula, you know, that can be worked
out. Well, you've been ranting about that all week, basically. I mean, or in relation to Time Magazine and... Yeah. I wanted to hear you verbalize that, because I've been hearing that in what you've been writing, this sort of exasperation that you've been obviously feeling.
It was just a pathetic display and a cover story in Time Magazine about Glenn Beck, and I guess the less said about it, the better. But
well, there was also the matter of estimating the size of the crowd that showed up on September 12th. That was kind
what
of an
that
story, too.
Episode was really about was trying to generate trust in yourself by distancing yourself from the liberals who say this and the conservatives who say that. And at this point in our crisis, that is just so lame and so unbelievable.
It is.
I just don't have any patience for it anymore.
Why does anybody pay attention to it? I mean,
increasingly they don't. This is not a rising property, you know.
But on the other hand, you know, if you listen, I mean, I do listen to On the Media. I try to keep current with that. And, you know, I think that's pretty much it. I listen to Fresh Air every once in a while, but that's really pretty sporadic.
Mm-hmm.
And this is what's disturbing to me, because I'm absolutely not watching the news. I'm barely reading the political news in the New York Times. I just am not interested. But I hear them saying that all this crazy stuff is influencing the supposed debate that we're having about healthcare reform. And
right.
I wonder about that, but if that's true, then that's really scary.
Well, the young and very talented news blogger Ezra Klein had a piece in the Washington Post this weekend called something like, "You don't know the cost of your health care." And it explained how the average American worker is paying something like $13,000 a year in health costs, but doesn't know that because the cost isn't direct. It's baked into their wages. Some of it is paid in copays and things that you actually disperse yourself, but most of it's not. And it's hidden in the very complexity and opacity of the healthcare delivery system. And if people understood how much more they were paying for healthcare over the last 10 years, over the last 20 years, the atmosphere of crisis would be such that the political situation would be completely different. But since most of those costs are hidden away, they're indirect, they're very difficult to grasp, the political situation is completely different. So opacity affects the politics of the issue. And of course, for journalists, the challenge is that if costs are hidden like that, if the details of the problem are unavailable to us, it's part of their challenge, it's part of their job to change that situation. And I'm not saying it's easy to do that, and they are not the only ones with that responsibility. But if you don't know how to tackle that challenge, if it's just too much for you, if it's too big, if you don't have enough of a grip on it, then the alternative is to focus on the political fighting that results from that opacity, you see? And that's where the church of the sad beat comes in.
Well, we've talked about this before, that the issues of, I mean, there was this fantastic op-ed piece by David Brooks in the New York Times where he talked about basically that what healthcare is doing is just sucking the resources out of almost everything else we do in this country. And, you know, this is what Obama has been trying to say, is that if we want to get the deficit under control, if we want a financial system that works in this country, this is the thing we have to deal with. And it's so totally true.
It's totally true. And the alternative to a press that helps us dig into that is the whole savvy approach. And to give you a perfect example of that, this week, Ben Smith, who's a reporter for the Politico and probably one of the best examples we could find of the savvy inside Washington journalist, posted that little thing on Twitter that was just so revealing of the current state of Washington journalism. He says that he was going on WBUR in Boston to discuss this Acorn controversy, aiming to irritate both sides. That was his statement. And just this whole idea that if you irritate both sides, you have done your job, suggesting, of course, that both sides are kind of equally misleading, that if you're in the middle between both sides, then you're somehow associated with the truth, and that if you succeeded in irritating these people and those people, that means we can trust you. That whole set of propositions is, in my view, completely corrupt, and that's why I was so mad at Time Magazine, because it's almost nihilistic. It's almost like giving up on journalism, because it's completely formulaic. Now, at the other end of the spectrum is someone who I actually wanted to bring up as my inspiration of the week, but I wanted to develop it a little bit more. So rather than just do it at the end, I wanted to sort of start talking about it in the middle, if that's all right with you. My inspiration of the week is the blogger and writer and journalist Andrew Sullivan, who, if you follow me on Twitter, I often send out things that he said or linked to. And Andrew Sullivan is a very unusual figure in American journalism. First of all, he's a Brit who became an American. He calls himself a conservative, but he's moved ideologically a lot during the Bush years, and he became an extremely harsh critic of Bush. He's been among the hardest hitters on the torture question, and dead set against American policy in adopting torture. And he has a very strong following, because about 6-7 years ago, he just discovered how potent blogging is.
Mm-hmm.
And probably more than any other Washington journalist, realized that blogging was going to transform the relationship between journalists and their users. And there's three things I wanted to bring up about him that really inspire me. One is, he wrote in 2002, he wrote a blogger manifesto, which tried to explain why he had poured so much energy into his blog, which has actually traveled around a lot in the years. It started as an independent site, and then he blogged for Time Magazine, and now he's with The Atlantic. But it's still him. And he discovered right away that he could have a lot of readers, which is also the reason that I started blogging. Just the whole idea that you could have thousands of readers for yourself as opposed to borrowing them from somebody else was one of the reasons that I started my blog. But without actually realizing it, he developed a larger following for himself than he had ever had for example, the New Republic magazine. And he'd been the editor of the New Republic.
Mm-hmm.
With the crisis following September 11th in 2001 and with the onset of the Iraq War in 02 and 03, his audience surged. And in his blogger manifesto, he wrote about this in a very compelling way. And I just want to read a little bit about what he said there. He said, "Suddenly it felt as if this event were not just happening to me, but to all of the little community the weblog had pioneered. I started writing about my feelings, and readers responded with an intensity I've never felt in any other journalistic form. For a few months, the site was entirely about the war, a place where every possible argument about the conflict could be grappled with. People sent in poems, stories, first-person accounts, until the site became a clearinghouse for September 11th reflection. The blog almost seemed designed for this moment. In an instant during the crisis, the market for serious news commentary soared. But people were not just hungry for news, I realized. They were hungry for communication, for checking their gut against someone they had come to know, for emotional support and psychological bonding. In this world, the very personal nature of blogs had far more resonance than the more impersonal corporate media products. Readers were skeptical of anonymous news organizations anyways and preferred to supplement them with individual writers they knew and liked. My audience doubled literally overnight." So this is inspiring just in and of itself, because that insight he had, that people are hungry not just for information, but for human connection, can, I think, really inject journalism with the life that it needs in the rebooted system. A second thing about Sullivan that's really impressed me is that along with Josh Marshall and a few other bloggers, he has developed something that I would call the journalism of the inbox. And what I mean is he has very devoted readers who send him stuff all the time. And it could be links, it could be letters in reaction to something he wrote, it could be book chapters, but they send a lot of stuff. And he doesn't have comments on his blogs, but he has a very prominent link to Contact, the Daily Dish, which is the name of his site. And he employs one or two people who are assistants to comb through that material. And so he's discovered the art of curation, and he employs it to really good effect, because while most of the stuff that he gets he doesn't use, he regularly uses enough that it incentivizes people to keep contributing. And so by regularly using what comes in from readers, he has made them very much a part of the site, and he's discovered the truth in what Dan Gilmore said so many years ago that my readers know more than I do. And to him, it's not a slogan. It's actually a method of doing journalism. And this idea of the inbox as kind of the way you start your editorial day is, I think, really important to doing effective online journalism. And there's a connection between what he said about the emotional bond that users have with the site and their willingness to send stuff like that, because they're not going to send it to you if they don't trust you. Finally, just today in the New York Times, there's a little item about Sullivan, and it noted that after the Atlantic magazine published his open letter to President Bush on torture, in which he says to Bush, look, I agree that it's going to be hell if we have to go through and investigate everybody who is connected with the decision to start torturing people, and it's probably not good for American politics to do that. And the only way we can avoid that is if you take responsibility and explain exactly why you did that and stand up and, like, be a man. So that was his letter, right? And the Atlantic decided to put it on the cover of the magazine, which was a bold move because it's not exactly a way to sell magazines. So in gratitude for the Atlantic supporting him like that, he just made a pitch at his blog, hey, look, subscribe to the magazine, because it's the magazine and its subscription base and advertising that makes it possible for me to do this. So you've got to do your part. And as a result, they had a surge in subscriptions. They had double what they normally get from the web site in the month as a result of this plea, which tells us something about the importance of this bond between blogger and readers, because it's the blogger selling the magazine, not the magazine giving a platform to the blogger, if you see what I mean.
Yeah.
And in these ways, here's a political journalist who could easily have become a Ben Smith, who could easily have become a Washington insider, who, by opening himself to blogging and to the two-way web, has really become one of our top bloggers. And when the crisis in Iran broke out and people were suddenly starved for information, he was the one who was curating tweets and cries for help from within Iran and running them in his column. And he didn't need a word of instruction about it. He already knew how to do that, and he knew what the power of that would be. So I don't agree with Sullivan in a lot of his politics. I often want to clobber him for things that he said. He can irritate me at times, but, and I've never met him personally, but I feel I have a connection with him, and I'm a fan of his, and he is somebody, if you care about journalism and what the web can do for it, he's somebody that I would recommend following.
Good story. I mean, that is the, I mean, you could kind of quantify it. It would be kind of interesting, because that is the difference. That's how blogging, it's a bootstrap, basically, every day. What you're saying is he, you know, creates every day on his blog by picking up, you know, by just sort of trusting that his whatever, the universe will provide whatever stimulation he needs to express himself or, you know. I mean, it's the way we did the development of blogging in the first place. It's the way we're doing the bootstrap on RSS Cloud right now. You know, it's like, for example, I'll give you an example. I had this sort of intuition that, you know, it's not unique. A lot of people have had it. But I didn't know that, by the way, at the time I was thinking about it, was that we could use the sort of structure of the internet itself to implement the Twitter-like, loosely coupled Twitter-like functionality
mm-hmm.
that we're trying to create. And that means using the domain name system, which is, you know, how you convert a string of characters into the physical address of a machine. And I just threw something up against the wall and said, you know, tell me what you all want to do with this. And so basically what happened was people started yelling at me, saying, no, you don't understand it. You know, why didn't you do your – there's a lot of this. Why didn't you do your homework before you posted this? You always hear that.
Mm-hmm. All people tell me that.
I'm doing my homework right now. That's, you know, I could try – you know, we have this fight, by the way, on inberkeley.com over and over and over again. And it's you know, somebody will bring a story that they want to work on. These are all former reporters, by the way. And they would bring a story to the mail list and say, I want to go start working on this thing. Does anybody have any idea about, you know, this, that, or the other thing related to this? And it makes me want to pull my hair out because, you know, what I say is, look, would you just put up a blog post about that and ask the people who read the blog what they think about that instead of asking us, because you've got five people here on this mail list, and the chances that any one of us has any expertise on this is pretty damn small. But we've got a few thousand people out there that are actually paying attention to us. The odds are much higher that those people, that somebody out there is going to have an idea. And the thing I've learned over the years of doing this is that people love to contribute what they know. You know,
that's
if
true.
You ask somebody, if you ask a general question, you know, does anybody know this? And somebody actually does. I don't think they don't usually sit on their keyboard. You know, they usually start typing. And,
yeah, and they don't say, what's in it for me? You know why journalists don't do that?
No. Why don't journalists do that?
Because they think that if they go public with their request, somebody's going to steal their story.
I don't think it's quite, you know, that's the conventional wisdom. I hear it all the time, but I'm not exactly sure that that's what's going on.
What's going on?
Well, because it's almost an existential thing. Okay, I could ask another question that's sort of similar to that. Is, all right, and I wrote a piece today that's entitled YWFFTMMR, which stands for You Work for Free to Make Me Rich. And that is the basic principle of every tech company out there, okay? And I'm seeing this in, like, you know, it always gets, I always get a huge dose of this whenever I get hot. Okay. Whenever whatever I'm doing looks like it's going to make somebody rich, these dickheads come swooping in and say to me that. That's what they say to me. I've even had guys look me in the eye, face to face, and say, no, Dave, you work for free, but I don't work for free. And I go, well, whatever gave you the idea that I work for free? Okay. So I know that I'm telling this the long way, but let me try to bring this around.
Yeah, bring it back around.
I know, but you took a fair amount of time here too, so I'm going to take a little bit of time to get this idea out there. So, so if you ask one of these companies, tech companies, let's say you were a shrink and you had this guy on the couch and he knew that you would never tell anybody what he was saying, you'd say, well, why don't you offer your users stock in the company? You know, why don't you just correct this problem? You know, this is obviously because they know that there's an imbalance there. They know that there's a line in there that says, these guys don't get stock, but these guys do. In other words, these guys have a chance of making some money, some even getting filthy rich, but these other people have absolutely no hope of it. It can't happen. We're depending on them, you know. Well, that's what they're worried about. They're worried about that if they break this line and start sloshing out stock across that line so there's equity amongst the free workers now, then how will you be able to tell the difference between somebody who works for free and somebody who gets paid? That's the problem the reporters are dealing with, because it's the same existential problem. If I go to my readers and ask them to do my job for me, what do they need me for? Right? This is what they can't wrap their minds around, right? But this is like, you know, 10 years ago when people were asking me about this stuff. Like, I got invited to Davos in 2000. I was one of the journalistic guys. You know, I worked every session that we went to was like, you know, we would meet with the president of some country or whatever. And the other people were the publishers of the biggest publications in the world. And they would ask me, like, you know, well, what's the business model? How does your stuff work? And I go, you know, it's like jumping out of an airplane without a parachute. You don't know how you're going to get down there. You don't know how you're going to land safely. But you have to do it anyway. Mm-hmm. So the reporter pretty much has to do this now, right? That's the point of your story, is that look at how well it works for Andrew Sullivan, and look at what a whore Ben Smith has become, right? So if you have a choice and you have some integrity and you have some idealism about what it means to be a reporter, what's the choice? I mean, obviously you want to go the Andrew Sullivan route, but the problem is that if you're not one of these guys that is willing to jump out of the plane without a parachute, you can't figure out how it works. One of these days, these people who are doing all the work for me are going to realize that they don't need me. This is the worry, right? Of course they do need you. They couldn't. Andrew Sullivan is one of those truly unreplaceable people. He's one of these guys who has made himself so valuable to that community that the last thing they would ever think about is, well, how do we get rid of Andrew Sullivan?
Yes, and he can also move from one place to another, and his community goes with him.
Absolutely. When they say buy the Atlantic, they buy the Atlantic, you know. Mm-hmm. Pretty soon he's going to be able to buy a newspaper, and I don't just mean buy copies of the newspaper, but he'll buy the whole damn thing, right? Mm-hmm. That's how, by the way, the whole system ends up reforming, you know. It's, and you're, like, we've been in agreement on for, you know, however many episodes, that we're already living in the rebooted world. Well, Andrew Sullivan is the rebooted world.
Yes.
So the point, okay, so there's the point.
Yeah. You know, I'm hearing more and more rumblings that the New York Times is getting close to a decision on paid content. And,
haven't we been hearing that for a long time? I thought they were going to give us the answer in July or June. I think it was June, by the end of June.
Yeah, we have been hearing it. We heard it all summer, actually. But now,
now they're really doing it for
now
real.
They're getting down to the real hard decisions. And
so?
Well, there's three possible directions I see. One is some kind of membership model, as it's called, where there's still free content, but if you become a member, you get... And then is like tiered service is the second model, which is the Financial Times formula.
Nonsense. This is wrong, Jay. You
and
know
the third is actual paywall, meaning no free content for anybody and pay up. And according to what I've heard, of course, my sources are not super great, but I have some. And according to what I heard, they're actually considering a serious paywall as like one of the options. So we'll see. I mean, whatever decision they make is going to be an important, fateful moment in the history of that institution.
Yeah. You know, it's too bad because, you know what, I want to ask you a question, okay? Do you think that they asked any users what they want?
They have, actually.
Have they really? And the users said, well, if we want a paywall, that's the one thing we absolutely insist on. We have to have a paywall.
No, but they've been asking people, like, would you be willing to do this?
Right.
Would you
it's
willing
like,
to do
can
that?
You handle, how bad a taste are you willing to... Will you still eat the food if we put all this terrible stuff in it, right? will you still sit
down
and
have
your bowl
of
oatmeal
if
you know there's a certain amount of arsenic in it, you know? Okay, how much arsenic can we put in it before you say, no, I'm not going to eat that? I mean, the point is that it's so silly because I really think they have the product everybody wants. All they have to do is just, instead of saying, what would you be willing to swallow, is what's your dream? What do you dream of? What would you love to see in the news? And if you really, really get them to start dreaming about what they'd love to see in the news, then what they would see is the New York Times already has it.
Well, they are asking questions like that. I joined something called the Times Lab or something like that, where they ask particularly dedicated users to join, and they give you survey questions about different features.
Why do they ask survey questions? Why don't they give you open-ended questions? You know, why? Because I can't dream in a survey question.
Well, there are ways to give open-ended answers.
And
as
by
well.
The way, they had a meeting in Silicon Valley like that, and guess who wasn't invited?
What kind of a meeting was it?
Amongst people who were supposedly very knowledgeable about news and technology.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I mean, okay, fine. I know. You know, they had this great meeting in New York where they had all the technological leaders in the news business and. You know, well, unfortunately, I didn't find out about that until it was actually happening. I mean, I, you know, with all arrogance, you know, I actually do believe that they should actually kind of listen to what I have to say, but whatever. You know, it's,
there are benefits.
They have filters, man. I just think that's what it is. I think they're only willing to accept a certain range of answers, and I think that's the problem with their system.
Well, these institutions are challenged, as you know, by the new environment. So it's I do sympathize with them to some degree, because it's very hard to figure out how to navigate the rebooted system for news if you have to start with one of these giant institutions.
Well, who has guts in this space, Jay? I mean, I'm looking for somebody to partner with right now, because we've got this fantastic bootstrapping system that's really great at delivering news very, very, very quickly, okay? And it's reaching the point now where in a few weeks, I think, maybe 8 weeks, a couple of months, it's really going to be booted up and actually running. And I want some news organizations, or one news organization that's really, really embraced it and is throwing news out there real time, you know, and letting developers build all kinds of crazy systems around it. Who would be, which news organization would you go to? Which door would you go knock on?
You're talking about RSS Cloud and a
of
partner
course.
To help you develop it, you mean?
No, I want them to do, I want them to use it.
To use it.
I built this baseball stadium, okay?
Yeah.
And you can play a phenomenal game of baseball. I really think it's a revolutionary stadium, like, you know, the Camden Yards were in Baltimore whenever they got built. You remember? I don't know if you're a baseball fan, but Baltimore has...
I know Camden Yards, yep.
They started the revival in baseball by taking a whole different view of what a baseball stadium should be, and now all the stadiums are modeled after Camden Yards. Mm-hmm. I believe that's where I'm at right now, almost there. Okay, I got this great stadium. Now, who wants to play a game inside of it?
Mm-hmm. Well, what I would do is, rather than pick by institution, I would pick by, I would find a news geek at a news organization that got it.
Yeah, of course.
And convince that person and
throw me something under the table. That's how we do it always. Absolutely.
Yeah.
That's how we got to do RSS in the first place.
Example would be Brian Boyer, a young programmer geek at the Chicago Tribune.
Mm-hmm.
But there are such people at the New York Times as well, or there are people at the LA Times who are in that sort of position. But I would start with a person, and then help that person sell, you know, their boss, who then sells their boss. that's probably.
You may not have to do a whole lot of selling.
Yeah, maybe not. Yeah,
maybe it may. You know, this is the kind of thing that could be done skunkwork style. But then the problem comes up. Is that once you reach the end point where you've got the whole thing working, now can you do anything to get them to acknowledge it and promote it, you know? Which was the problem that we hit with the River of News, the New York Times River.com, which predated Twitter by at least a year and delivered pretty much the benefits of Twitter, and then they couldn't even take a look at it because they had just, you know, because they couldn't. The idea that an idea, an innovative technological idea, came from outside of their own organization was something that could not penetrate. So eventually it does need to be recognized by the organization for it to have a chance.
Yes. NPR would be another one to consider. NPR certainly might be open to something like that. They are
Andy
banking.
Carvin, is that who I...
Andy Carvin would be somebody to contact.
Yeah, yeah.
They're banking on free and open news, you know,
yeah.
and their CEO is absolutely convinced that paywalls cannot work, and that open is the way to go. So
they're built on that foundation, right?
Yeah, and they have an API.
NPR, have you ever heard the show, the podcast Radio Lab?
Yeah, it's a great show.
Oh, my God, is it so good.
Totally
those are
great.
Some people I'd love to meet. I would love to meet those guys.
Yeah.
Just to talk to them about possibilities, because their minds work. They're so alive, you know. I mean, it seems to me they would be interested in playing games here, you know.
Meanwhile, This American Life is supposedly working on a healthcare explainer, and I am really looking forward to that.
Right on. Boy, we always get to good stuff right at the end. Oh, we have. The last one was really good, too, wasn't it? At the very, very end, it got good. Because we are now down to, I think, 30 seconds.
Well, each rebooting the news has its own little
that's
drama.
Has its own what?
its own drama and arc.
Drama. Yeah, well, I think this one was pretty good. Oh, 10 seconds. Well, my friend Jay, it's been another lovely week, and we'll see you again next week, okay?
Been a pleasure. Bye, Dave.
Bye.